So welcome to the Growth House podcast, a podcast exclusively focused on leadership, on teamship, and on growth. And it's great pleasure today to be in conversation with Vicky Anstey. I'm not going to do a really long intro because I want in the first few questions to let Vicky introduce herself. But let me just give you a couple of ideas or a couple of things from her bio. Vicky is a leading fitness expert, an entrepreneur turned adventurer, a world record holder. She's one of the first women to reach the final stages of the hit Channel 4 show, SAS Who Dares Wins. She secured a new world record for rowing the Mid-Pacific unaided. And she's just completed a 230-kilometer run across the Arctic in temperatures as low as 30 degrees below freezing. Vicky, welcome home. You're just back recently, right?
Yeah, that's right. Just back about 4 days. So body's still kind of recovering, still trying to take on the extra calories I need, a little bit in deficit on the old calorie front. But yeah, feeling good, feeling really elated, I guess, to have done it, to have completed it, to have experienced, you know, one of the most northernmost remote parts of the world. Just a phenomenal experience.
And you were saying just before we started recording the sort of the contrast of what was going on in the world last week and where you were and what you were doing kind of couldn't have been more extreme, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. Obviously, since we've been back, we've been catching up. We were quite, out there without really any communications, any notion of what's really going on in the world. And it's devastating to see what's happening. And I've kind of struggled with it really since being back and wanting to share elements of our journey and all the incredible things that we've learned and been through. It feels a bit out of place really, given everything else that's going on. But actually, I guess my overriding learning is we live on the most beautiful planet. You know, the stuff out there that I feel incredibly privileged to have seen and experienced, and it kind of only serves to highlight the senseless destruction that is going on at the moment. And so maybe it is the right thing to be sharing that story and some of the things that we went through, the hardships and a little bit more resilience built, and perhaps some of those things can help other people to get through tough times and deal with overwhelm.
Well, I think we need some, the other way of viewing it, I think, is it's so upsetting and demoralizing watching what is playing out at the moment. Some more inspiring and positive stories are what we all need at the moment. So yeah. I'm greatly looking forward to this. Tell me a little bit about this most recent challenge. Tell me what does a normal day look like when you're attempting that kind of distance and that kind of challenge?
There was a bit of a shock to the system. The night before we even began, we spent the night, quite an early night, about from about 9 p.m. onwards, in a teepee, sleeping on reindeer skins on the snow. I think the temperature dropped to about minus 35 that night. So we're in Arctic sleeping bags that will aim to keep you warm in temperatures of around minus 25. So it was a very, very cold night, and actually not everyone even made it through that. We were kind of huddled up, and you kind of close your sleeping bag into leaving you the tiniest little breath hole possible. And that was pretty brutal as a kickoff. Every day began pretty early. We'd set off around 6:30 or 7:30 a.m. and carrying everything that we needed to survive for the whole 5 days, all of our food, etc. So obviously our backpacks became lighter as the week went on, thankfully.
What kind of weight did that start with then on
I'd say it was probably about 12 to 15 kilos to begin with. Okay. Yeah. we ran very little actually in the end. You know, we hadn't had that much experience using snowshoes. So Kate and I, the girl that I did it with, had gone to Hyde Park for about half an hour one Friday afternoon to run in the horse tracks and the sand to get a feel for how these snowshoes were in running and walking. And that was the extent of our experience in using them. So we were very much kind of learning on the spot. But yeah, a little bit of running where we could, but mostly snowshoeing, using our ski poles, quite a lot of upper body actually involved.
Really?
Yeah. You know, some of the terrain was at quite an incline, a lot of elevation, a lot of frozen lakes. So that's just hours. You know, at one point we crossed a 20-kilometer frozen lake, so your scenery doesn't change much for hours and hours and hours, which is pretty tough on the mind. But yeah, just stopping at each checkpoint. There were checkpoints every 10 or 15 kilometers, and trying not to spend too much time stopping there because it's tough to get going again. But yeah, just constant movement. I think that's the really the toughest thing about this race. And I haven't done the Marathon de Sable, but a number of people who did the race with us in the Arctic had, and said it was so much harder for the fact that you literally cannot stop because you are reliant on your body heat.
Yeah.
To keep you alive, essentially. And people were airlifted out for hypothermia and didn't finish for that reason as well. So, you know, it's quite a serious risk.
And how many people racing? How many people?
So there were 30 that started. I think maybe 32 that started. 12 didn't finish.
Wow.
Yeah, someone got airlifted out. A couple of people were rescued on skidoos by the Sami guys who are out there to support. It's their, you know, they know that environment like the back of their hand and they can get around pretty quickly. So yeah, that had to happen. But at times you felt extremely exposed, especially in blizzard conditions, where you can barely see your hand in front of your face, let alone the markers that show you where the path is. In fact, the path would often blow over anyway with snow, so you know, fresh footprints, and felt like going through quicksand a lot of the time.
And you came 12th overall, and I think you finished with Kate, the legend who is Kate Smythe.
I think
you finished with the second fastest women in the whole.
Yeah, that's right. So there was only one other woman who completed it. There were seven of us in total to start with. This girl who won, well, she actually came second place overall, you know, is a professional ultra trail runner, used to those conditions, lives in Slovakia, had, you know, plenty of experience using the snowshoes, made it look very easy. But yeah, we were thrilled. Well, I mean, we were thrilled to complete it. That goes without saying. And then to, you know, be amongst the only women who completed it, and to come 12th overall in the middle of the pack was pretty
amazing.
Pretty good outcome, yeah.
And a theme that we might come back to a couple of times. Could you talk at all about the balance between the physical and the mental challenge, and the degree to which those things are connected, separate, which you focus on more, which you prepare for more? Could you talk a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, I mean, they are so interlinked, aren't they? And, you know, like any of these kinds of challenges and things that I've done before, you know, invariably it is 80% mental, 20% physical, which seems ridiculous when you think about, you know, the physical challenge that's involved. All I'd say is our bodies are capable of just so much more than we ever think they are. So actually the physical aspect pales into some insignificance. And really it's just about, once you are physically depleted, what have you got left mentally? You know, and I've learned that through the SAS Who Dares Wins experience, also through the ocean row that I did. Your body is going to break down at a certain point, but you know, your mind can keep going, and it's just about working through pain thresholds and understanding that, and knowing that you're going to be okay and you'll pull through. And that's really just your brain on high alert trying to promote self-preservation at all costs. You can override that. Just dealing with the mundane, I think. So, you know, so many of these things, whether it's stroke after stroke or, you know, step after step, it's just about getting it done and not thinking about the end too much, just breaking it down as much as you can and keeping your brain occupied and just bringing your focus into the journey, really, rather than the end point.
So we'll talk a little bit about each of them, but maybe let's go back a bit. Let's understand a little bit about your backstory, because I don't think you were born an elite adventurer. I don't think that's how life started, is it?
No, it's not. I'm not sure many people are born elite adventurers, but I definitely wasn't. I was at the very opposite end of that spectrum. I guess I grew up in an environment where, you know, girls didn't do that kind of thing. I didn't really have any, certainly, female role models around me promoting, fitness and exercise, let alone, endeavors of this kind. So it really wasn't on my radar. I went into, after school and university, I went into a corporate lifestyle. I worked in advertising and marketing for many years, which I loved and have taken so much from. It was, as I'm sure you know, Ben, all too well, quite a hedonistic lifestyle. And, you know, I neglected my health and my fitness, which had never really been a priority to me anyway. But I just had a light bulb moment at one point, sat at my desk thinking, is this what life's all about? And, inevitably the shine comes away at a certain point, however much you're enjoying your career, and certainly in advertising, you know, it can be extremely fun and glitzy. And then you kind of at a certain point see through that, I think, or I did. And I wanted more out of life. And so I started to prioritize my health and my fitness a bit more. And I guess the one thing I definitely was born with is a bit of a stubborn streak. And, once I get my head into something, I rarely quit. I never quit, really, is the truth of that. I just began to realize what incredible benefits, being active had for my physical state and my mental and emotional state. And I started to do short runs, and the short runs turned into marathons. And then I discovered BAR, which is a method of fitness based on ballet. I'd never done ballet before in my life, but I thought I'd give that a go. Someone said it was a bit like exercising without exercising, so I thought that was right up my street. And I very quickly became addicted to that. It transformed my body. And I actually ended up quitting my career in advertising to train full time. Saw a huge opportunity to bring BAR to the UK, where it really was, almost non-existent, but quite well known in the US. And I witnessed that, spent a lot of time in New York training and getting under the skin of the BAR scene there. And I brought that back to the UK and set up the first BAR studio, dedicated BAR studio, back in 2009. And ran that business for 12 years. And, you know, that was kind of the mainstay of my fitness regime. It was the kind of constant underlying thing. And even when I then in later years got into a lot more extreme stuff and weightlifting and CrossFit and military fitness and still lots of running, BAR was the kind of the glue that held my body together. And I don't know if you've ever done it, but it's pretty mentally taxing as well. So it's that kind of discipline of ballet that transcends through. And you kind of can't focus on anything else while you're doing it. It's so tough. And I think that's, that's shaped my mental strength to some degree. And and throughout that whole period of time, I was in a very long-term relationship. Which was quite a limiting relationship, actually. And again, I let myself listen to and believe other people's narratives about myself until I'd had enough. And I was in the approach to my 40th year, and I decided that life didn't have to be like that, or at least the second part of my life didn't have to be like that. And so I chose to leave that relationship. And took up a new path in life and celebrated my capabilities and you know, I let the other people around me who were trying to celebrate my physical capabilities do that and encourage me to do things like signing up to do SAS Who Dares Wins, which I did shortly after leaving that was a 20-year relationship. So it was a big deal to, you know, basically restart my life and learn how to be on my own and manage my own affairs, which I'd never been allowed to do prior to that point. So that's been a huge learning curve. And my physical fitness helped enormously with that. It allowed me to become, you know, I lent on my physical strength to build up my emotional strength and my mental strength.
Let's talk about limitations. I'm fascinated by that as an idea or as a space, because I mean, you talked about limitations being put on you by a third party, but we often put limitations on ourselves as well, don't we? So I'm really interested in that and how you probe and sort of test the borders of your limitations. Talk to me a little bit about the first few times you felt yourself pushing those boundaries.
I think I just I had a one day where I sort of saw through the smoke and mirrors of it, of the relationship, and that left me with a deep sort of sickening feeling in my stomach, this kind of dawning realization that things were not as I thought they were, and that all the things that I'd been told were extremely complicated and I wasn't possibly capable of managing myself. I suddenly started to think, well, maybe that's not true. And all it took, and I say all it took, not to understate that, was to take that first step into saying, well, I'm going to do this on my own, in spite of what I'm being told, and I will find out whether I can. And taking that first step, however small it is, brings immediate rewards. And that's, I'm so passionate about trying to encourage other people to do that. And I think it's so easy to stay in situations that are limiting or damaging in whatever respect, because you simply, you're paralyzed and you don't know how to step out of that situation. You've got nothing to draw upon in terms of your own experience of being able to take a different path. It's extremely overwhelming, but just to do that in any small way, you suddenly start to learn and realize what you are capable of. I just started saying yes to things. And so friends who had kind of, you know, witnessed that situation getting worse over the years, especially, saw me come out of it and took me into experiences that I would never have taken up before that point. And then it's just an iterative process and quite an addictive cycle. And you start to realize, oh my God, I can do that. And then I can do that. And then that translates into, you know, mental and emotional pressures and how you might handle those. And you start to think, well, this isn't as difficult as the stress of a divorce, or it's not as difficult as the stress of, you know, picking all the pieces of my life up and moving forward with that. So everything becomes relative. You find new edges and start to truly explore your potential. And I guess I kind of went into that in quite an extreme way applied under duress, under pressure from my friends for the SAS Who Dares Wins program, almost to shut them up. And then I found myself in Chile and each day getting through it, realizing, oh my God, I've just got through the next day and I've just got through the next day. And these guys and girls, so I did it the first year I did it, was the first year they allowed women to participate in the show, which I still find quite staggering. There have only been 4 shows where women are allowed to participate. But just seeing other people kind of fall by the wayside as I went through the process, it's hugely motivating. in the kindest possible way. Of course, I wanted everyone to do well, but that's not the nature of the program. But, you know, that really, it pushes you on and puts fire in your belly and just makes you feel alive. And I hadn't felt that way for a very long time.
I'm a massive fan of the show. I've watched all of them. We now, Jason Fox speaks for the Growth House, who's, I just think, got a fascinating narrative.
Yeah.
What are some of the things we don't see? What are the things we don't see in the show?
Well, that's such a good question, because I honestly would say the things that you don't see are the best things or the hardest things.
Right.
And often people say, what was the hardest thing you had to do? And they will always be the things that weren't shown on TV. And actually not even anything necessarily specific, although there are a number of activities that we did that you don't see, but it was the underlying anxiety and stress of never knowing what was coming next. And, they don't switch the cameras off and everyone has a cup of tea and a sit down and a chat. It's constant. And that's why, I just had the most incredible experience, and I, speak incredibly highly of it for that reason. It, of course, it is to some degree a kind of reality show. And I think it's kind of becoming more and more mainstream now, and a bit more focus on the sort of extreme stories of the individuals involved rather than the capabilities that they may have. But it was very real, and you could not switch that high state of adrenaline and anxiety off. And even at times where you might be in your accommodation, sitting on your fold-up bed, literally just following some horrendous task that we'd been asked to do, you didn't know if you had 5 minutes or 3 hours. You didn't know when you went to bed if it was even worth taking your boots off. Often I didn't, because they could come storming back through the door at any moment, screaming at you. It's just a constant state of high alert. And that was tough to tolerate for 11 days. That was tough to tolerate.
And one of the things they say about the selection process is it's often very surprising people, or it is for those of us that haven't been through it. It's not the most obvious people that make it, is it? It's not the most athletic looking or the people who are necessarily even the best prepared. Back to your 80-20 mental.
Yeah.
It always fascinates me, the people who are still there at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I am not the fastest, the strongest, the fittest, or, the most talented in any way at all. I learned pretty quickly that it really wasn't about, how fast you went. It was about how many times you prepared to pick yourself up and go again and again. It sounds like a cliche, and it is a bit, but that's the truth of it. They literally just wanted to see how far you're prepared to go to get the task done. And, ultimately they don't want people in SAS selection who are going to quit easily or at all. So that's what it came down to. And then in a sense, you could kind of take the pressure off yourself a little to think, well, I don't have to reach that point first, but I have to be seen to be constantly grinding towards it. I'd done a fair bit of military fitness, which actually prepared me really well. Not as in any way as extreme as the program, but I understood the kind of mentality behind listening to instruction carefully and executing requests and just some of the kind of basic military things. And the other thing actually that I did, I tried to prepare myself mentally a little bit, and I spoke to someone anonymously, who was formerly in the special services. And this guy told me that human beings only need 90 minutes of sleep a night to function. And I was quite amazed and sort of didn't really believe him. But when I first got there and realized how little sleep we were getting, I think the first night we maybe had 2 hours sleep. And they put us on night watch every night in order to keep us awake if we weren't out doing, middle of the night tasks anyway. But, I remember sort of soothing myself my own anxieties that next day, thinking, well, I've had more than 90 minutes. I've had 2 hours. So I'm good. I'm good to go. I'll be fine. You know, and it's amazing. You just have those kind of mental tools available to fall back on. And you know, you can kind of talk yourself in and out of anything, can't you? But that was a useful piece of knowledge.
Back to limitations. I think, so Will Greenwood, who I think, you know, I've done this book with, he draws this really interesting distinction between the way many people train, and he definitely put himself in this camp, which is, I need to know what the session is, I need to know how many reps, I need to know what the end point is, so that I've just got enough energy to get myself over the line. And then he contrasts Johnny Wilkinson arriving and getting on the start line, not needing to know how many, how much, and just going as hard as he could.
Yeah.
And he explains that people like Johnny changed the way his England team thought about the intensity of their work. So it was better to finish with your last set less good than your first set, rather than be a last set hero. Yeah. And that is fascinating to me as a mindset of, you know, pushing your boundaries, emptying the tank, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you ever find out what your limitations are, do you?
I hope I never find out what my limitations are. I hope there are always adventures and challenges out there where I'm surprising myself. And I think because I didn't grow up as a, you know, a sporty teenager or, you know, a young athlete in any way, I am constantly surprising myself, because I still think of myself as being, you know, someone who isn't from that camp. And, you know, so, but yeah, I one of the best pieces of advice I ever received was to just switch your brain off. It doesn't matter. Like, how far is it? Doesn't matter. How many reps are there? Doesn't matter. You just keep going. And, you know, the more you think about it, the more you ruminate, the worse you make it for yourself. And I've, you know, I've definitely had to apply that to things like the Pacific row, where we had no idea how long that was really going to take us. You know, in some ways the ice ultra was kind of easier in that regard, because we knew exactly what distance we had to cover. When we were there, we were there, and we could then get a few hours sleep and go again the next day, and it was going to be over on, you know, 5 days later. Yeah, it's far harder when you have no endpoint in sight and you have to just keep going anyway.
And let's talk about the row. That was a team event. Was it three of you?
Yeah, three women. Yes.
Tell us a little bit about how long that was and what you learned on that adventure.
Yeah, so that was it took us 60 days, 17 hours and 6 minutes. So we just snuck in under the world record by 2 days. And actually when we left, we were full of bravado and thought it would take us 45 days. So it took us, you know, a good 15 days longer than we'd anticipated. And although, you know, we had enough food just supplies, etc., mentally having to deal with realizing halfway across that we were nowhere near where we thought we ought to be or could have been by that point, that was quite difficult to deal with. And of course you can do nothing about it, and that's, I think, one of the main things that the row taught me, was that, you know, rarely are we ever in situations that we cannot do anything about. You know, we're so easily able to control our environment, really, aren't we? And you know, back out of things if we change our minds. But that was a whole other level. But it was a long time in the making. I worked on that for 3 years. So I actually was originally meant to do the row in 2020, but it was postponed because of COVID. The two crewmates I was originally meant to do it with weren't able to defer their places. So, and I was the least experienced of all three by a long way. So I kind of couldn't really conceive of how I was going to keep that going. But by that point, we had all our sponsorship and we had so many people invested in supporting us, and we put so much into it. And I just, I seem to be physically incapable of saying no to anything really once I get going with it. So I just couldn't conceive of quitting, of pulling out. And so I called the guy who we were leasing the boat from, and I said to him, would he let me hold on to it for another year and I'd find new crew and I would get it under the Golden Gate Bridge in 2021. And he said yes and supported me 100%. And so yeah, I kind of had to set about resurrecting the whole thing during lockdown, doing all our training in our living rooms. All the gyms were closed, having to do all our mandatory courses and acquire all the skills that we had to acquire. So, you know, we had to learn about weather systems, we had to learn about boat competency, navigation, VHF radio communication. There's so many mandatory courses that we had to do to participate, and none of these courses were running in person. We had to try and persuade people to do them online. I had to find new crew. One of them was in Dubai and the other was in Wales. I didn't meet the girl who was in Dubai until we got to San Francisco before we left. So we were, all of us, taking a huge leap of faith, really. But just so passionate about doing it. And in fact, because then it became a completely novice crew and the other two girls had no experience either, so we were then all novices, it took on a whole new meaning, really. And you know, we were then able to engage and inspire people who weren't able to dismiss it as something that, well, they're professional rowers or they're, you know, rowing coaches, or they've done this kind of thing before, because none of us had. We were learning the whole thing from scratch. So it kind of took on a whole new energy, and I love that. But yeah, we set off underneath the Golden Gate Bridge on the 31st of May, and we arrived in Hawaii on the 31st of August.
Amazing.
31st of July, sorry.
And there might be people listening to this going, I'm inspired by the story, but you're just not like me. You're you're made of different stuff and it's amazing, but I just can't relate to it. Which is why I think you're honing in on take the first step and make it iterative. Yeah. Is so powerful, because I do believe that is the hardest thing for people to do.
And absolutely, yeah. And that's sort of one of the reasons why I always like to take on a new challenge that isn't something that already fits within my skill set. I honestly hadn't rowed more than maybe 500 meters in a CrossFit session before I suddenly started thinking, oh, I'm gonna have to sit on this thing for an hour or two or three. Same thing with the ice ultra. My running days are long gone. I literally went from couch to 20, 30 kilometers in a month. I am a huge believer in the idea of general physical preparedness. So, you know, I'm not someone that has to have a thing to train for. I feel very passionately about keeping our bodies in good working order. And that's as much for actually my brain and, my mental function as it is for anything physical, really. But, but that puts you in a position of being ready to do stuff. And, you know, people would say to me, well, how did you train for SAS Who Dares Wins? I genuinely didn't. I applied for it. I had 2 weeks notice before I went. And the only preparation I really did for that was going to a swimming pool with Mel, and because I have a fear of water, and him making me jump in and get uncomfortable underwater. I made him punch me in the face because I knew that was probably going to happen. To a large extent, the physical stuff just had to be there or it wasn't there. You know, it was just latent. And that's how I like to live my life. And I don't think that takes any great skill or talent. It just takes discipline. It takes, you know, a willingness to get up every day or, you know, several times a week and be active and push yourself. And, you know, it takes a mastery of the mundane. Like, that's the other thing, isn't it? You have to do the boring fundamentals really well day in, day out. You have to train when you don't want to, when it's raining, when you haven't got kit and you have to do something in your living room. You know, it's about silencing the excuses, isn't it? And just getting on with it. And then you don't have to be particularly talented or the best at anything. You're just generally ready for whatever life throws at you or whatever amazing experiences might come around the corner.
And I think that the relationship between well-being and resilience is not always articulated as well as I think you've just articulated it. I think people often do very, very little to invest in their well-being, and then they're surprised when a setback happens that they don't have the reserves to respond to it. And one of the things I like to talk to people about is, you know, well-being is all the proactive stuff you do to put money in the bank, and then when things go wrong, your resilience levels are higher. You're more able and more ready. And I think
And then you know when you're weak, you're working from a stronger base than you otherwise would be. Yeah. So even when you're depleted, or something's happened, or maybe you are injured, or you're just extremely stressed and under pressure for whatever reason in life, you know, your reserves are there. It's a sensible investment in just being healthy and living for as long as you can and being as mobile and independent as you possibly can. But it's really not even just about the physical. It's so much more about the mental and emotional. And I've had experiences in my life where I've really struggled on that level. And I know that physical activity feeds into mental and emotional endurance. Emotional endurance is something that I talk about a lot, and specifically in reference to the row. Because, you know, that was a tough experience, being in a confined space with two other people, and the relationship didn't always go well, really. And, you know, that was a very lonely place to be, quite a hostile place in an already hostile environment. So then how do you cope with that? You know, and obviously that's an extreme example, but I think we can all find ourselves at times in our lives where we feel lonely and in hostile environments, and then how do you respond to that? So putting yourself in an uncomfortable place brings huge reward, I think.
So amazingly, we're almost at the end of our time. That seems to have gone even quicker than usual. I think, you know, I always try to finish with these same three questions, but before I do that, it's just one other thing I wanted to ask you about, which is about purpose, about sort of personal purpose. So a lot of the work that we do at the Growth House with executive teams is around their organizational purpose, you know, the purpose of the business, trying to find connection between the individual's purpose and the purpose of the business.
Yeah.
I think I've got a sense of your motivation, but I'd love you to talk a little bit about your personal purpose, what really drives you and what the next chapter of your life is going to be about.
Yeah, I guess I have two purposes, I suppose. One relates back to my childhood and wanting to be the person that I needed when I was growing up, even if I didn't perhaps realize I needed that person. And now in hindsight, think, what a wonderful thing. If I could be that person for some other young girl or boy when they're growing up, to make them realize that they can do anything in this world and in this life, that's an incredibly motivating purpose for me. And I think the other one is about stepping into fear, encouraging people to step into their fears, because to me, fear is like opportunity in disguise. There's the most amazing stuff lies on the other side of your fears. And, I've kind of had to face fear in life in terms of having to be on my own and work things out on my own after a very long time of being, you know, limited and controlled by someone else. But then I've also actively chosen, as a consequence of that, to step into fears that I have around water and heights, and choosing to do an ocean row when I have a profound fear of deep water, deep open water. You know, I knew that that was going to force me into a process and a journey where I was going to have to deal with that and face up to it. It's easy to avoid stuff, isn't it, in life? And that's that's, I'm very driven by that thought. I don't want to live a life on the sidelines where I'm avoiding things and experiences because I'm afraid to kind of confront them. And even just speaking to you about it now, whenever I speak about it, I feel such a surge of passion. I if I could give that to someone else, just hand it to them, that would give me so much joy. And that's not possible. But so I feel very driven to show people in perhaps in extreme ways, but that can hopefully transcend into something that's, you know, accessible to them and applicable to their daily life. And you know, fears can exist in many different forms. It doesn't have to be about something like water or heights. It could be about, you know, could be, you could be afraid of success. You could be afraid of failure. You could be afraid of what other people think of you. So yeah, just kind of stepping into those fears. But I think having your purpose, identifying your purpose and communicating your purpose, particularly for an organization, is so important. And we didn't do that well on our ocean row. You know, we had our collective purpose was about inspiring other women and young girls to dream big and dare to do more with their lives. But what we didn't do as a team was sit down and discuss why or even if that was individually significant to each of us. And, you know, to me, that purpose set my heart on fire, but we weren't brave enough to kind of, or empathetic enough as a team. We didn't prioritize the kind of emotional side of things enough to have those conversations. And I think, you know, unless you do that in any team environment or any organization, you know, there's going to be disconnect and, you know, risk of things falling apart.
Well, you've got to keep telling that story. doing the amazing adventures is one part of the job, but you've got to keep telling it because it's an amazing story. And it's, I do think there's an interesting, I saw a fascinating post relating to this on gender and on how we raise our children and how boys are told to be brave. You know, it's a classic, and not enough girls are. Not enough girls in their early lives are given that as a motivation and story.
Girls are told to be pretty and quiet. Yeah, and boys are told to be brave.
I'm going to get to these three questions, if that's all right. So the first one is about leadership, and it's, what is the leadership behaviour that you admire the most?
Well, I've written three down.
Go on then, that's fine.
I've said tenacity. I never believe in saying you can't do something or that no should ever be an answer. There's got to be another way. And so I very much admire anyone who will lead with that kind of, yeah, behavior front of mind. Creativity would be another one, and integrity. Leading from your own life experiences is so important, I think. And yeah, just having the courage to be who you are and taking confidence from that other people will admire you and follow you if you are true to yourself and raw and authentic.
Brilliant. And then the same question really about teamship, about the behaviours of being in a high performance team.
Yeah. Well, I think I'd say based on my experiences, empathy would be number one. You know, the stark difference between, you know, the lack of empathy on the ocean row versus the experience that Kate and I've just had, albeit only 5 days versus 60. It's quite a difficult comparison to make. But just having that empathy and allowing for raw emotion and, you know, acknowledging how you're feeling and, you know, allowing that to be valid is so powerful. And then I think the other one that I'd say I learned from SAS, Who Dares Wins, and I don't know if this is really even a term, but I'm going to make it up if it isn't, is that oppo mentality. I don't know if that means anything to you, but in the military, the body system is incredibly powerful. And, you know, the idea that your body is more of a priority to you than you are to yourself, and that you are safe in the knowledge that they are doing the same for you, creates a very safe environment and a very trusting environment. And you know, I've lived through that, and I've seen the effects when it's done well and when it's not done well. And it's a very powerful kind of mentality to take into a team, I think.
So here's a funny thing. I've asked that question hundreds of times to speakers and to people, and only one person has ever said empathy the first thing, and that's Foxy.
Really? Yeah. Oh, well, there you go.
Well, it just always amazes me.
I'm in common. Foxy's a great guy. I learned so much from him.
Rough, tough, elite special forces guy. Yeah. And number one teamship behaviour. And the reason lots of people don't make it is empathy. So that's fascinating.
The other one, in fact, I had two others, if I can sneak them in. Positivity. Even when you don't feel like you can be positive or there's anything to be positive about, just, you know, forcing yourself to find good in the situation is so valuable. And forgiveness as well. And I think that probably links back to empathy. But, you know, mistakes happen. And if you have to hold on to those mistakes and make a point out of them to further your own interests, and then things will fall apart easily. You know, forgiveness is so important. We're all human, and things go wrong.
And the last question is about growth, and it's about the best bit of advice you could give to anybody about creating growth. And I mean growth in all its meanings: personal growth, growth of a team, growth of a business, whatever way you want to interpret it.
I think I'd say be prepared to fail, and almost want to fail. And almost even more than that, celebrate failing. I worked for IKEA many years ago, and they have an incredible culture of celebrating failure. And they used to have prize giving every year for the most colossal failure in the business, like someone placing an order, you know, and putting three more zeros on the end than they should have, or whatever it was, you know, the worst advertising campaign globally, for example, would be put up on a pedestal and everyone would have a good old laugh at it. And I took a huge amount from that, and I apply it to the physical endeavors that I do as well, and the things that I take on. Because if something doesn't scare you enough to think, what if I fail, then it's not big enough. It's not good. Well, you're not, maybe big enough to serve a certain purpose, but it's not going to be big enough to help you grow. And I think real growth comes not just, and you know, growth and resilience are quite closely interlinked. And I think real growth comes from not just kind of going out of your comfort zone, potentially failing at something a little bit, and then going back to where you started, bouncing back. Real growth comes from experiences where you're forced to change a little bit. And, you know, you fail, you learn from that failure. You never want to make that same mistake again. And that changes something in your psyche and creates the forward momentum that you need to continue your growth trajectory, I think. So yeah, just not being afraid of failure, just go for it. Celebrate. Right. Yeah.
So I think I've told you, but I'm very into my rowing now. I'm very into the indoor rower. I'd normally train at 7, but today I thought I would train after I'd spoken to you, because what I thought might happen is exactly what's happened, which is I'm now
revved up.
Yeah, and I'm going to test those limitations.
Amazing. Oh, that makes me very happy. Great.
That has been such a pleasure, Vicky, and there's so much in it. There are so many different parts of it. Fear is opportunity in disguise is a thing that is leaping out to me, but there's so much in that. Welcome back. I'm so glad you're home safe,
and
keep doing the challenges, but please get out there and keep telling the story as well.
Yeah, I intend to. I absolutely love talking about all this stuff. So
well done. Thanks so much.
Thank you.